From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, why so many of President Trump's own advisors are urging him to break a key promise on climate change, but not the man in charge of the White House's environmental agenda. A view from inside the EPA, where staff are rebelling against their new boss. It's Wednesday, April 19th.
Donald, if you were president right now and you were over in Paris, what is it you would be trying to do on climate change, and what is it you would be trying to prevent if you were leading the United States at the conference?
Well, first of all, I think one of the dumbest statements I've ever heard in politics, in the history of politics as I know it, which is pretty good, was Obama's statement that our number one problem is global warming. Okay.
In Donald Trump's populist campaign for president, nothing seemed to better encapsulate the out-of-touch elitism of government than the decision by his predecessor, Barack Obama, to sign a global climate agreement, the so-called Paris Accords.
When we have large groups of people that want to blow up every one of our cities, that want to destroy our country, that want to kill our people, and he's worried about global warming, I think it's one of the dumbest things I've ever seen, or perhaps most naive. He could be naive in a certain way. He actually, I think, is somewhat naive, if you want to know the truth, beyond the incompetent part.
Trump vowed that the moment he was in office, he would pull the U.S. out of the Accords.
We're going to cancel the Paris Climate Agreement. Unbelievable.
But the Times is reporting that there are growing doubts that the president will fulfill this particular pledge. Coral, thank you for coming on.
Michael, always a pleasure to be with you.
Coral Davenport writes about energy and the environment. So can you walk me through this Paris Climate Agreement, kind of why it's been considered so historic?
Sure. So the Paris Climate Agreement was reached in 2015. It is the first universal accord binding nearly every country on Earth, 196 countries, to do something about climate change. Every country that signed the accord has put forward a plan to reduce its emissions or in some way take action to tackle climate change. We've never seen anything like this. The diplomats have been working for 30 years to try to get something like this off the ground. So it was a very big deal when it happened.
A few hours ago, we succeeded. We came together around the strong agreement the world needed. We met the moment.
It was President Obama who helped negotiate and was a leader and signed the accord, put forth a pretty strong plan for the United States. It says that the U.S. will cut its greenhouse pollution about 26% from 2005 levels by 2025. That's a pretty significant decline. The foundation for that was President Obama's EPA regulations that would shut down coal-fired power plants. That's pretty much the only way to actually meet those tough numbers.
So what exactly have been President Trump's objections to it?
So President Trump on the campaign trail, he said this is a nightmare for the American economy. This is not America first. It was one of his signature pledges to, he used the word cancel, the Paris Agreement. You can't cancel a multilateral accord that's been legally ratified, but it would be possible for the United States to pull out. That would be pretty devastating to this accord if the world's largest economy were to entirely withdraw from it.
So just how devastating? I mean, what exactly are the consequences if the U.S. pulls out?
Well, the United States is the world's second largest carbon emitter. China is number one, but it's the largest historic emitter. It's put out more planet-warming pollution than any other country over the course of time. And really, the way the agreement came together was due to United States leadership.
Together, we've shown what's possible when the world stands as one.
President Obama made this a priority, you know, went around the world, got the players together.
Over the past 7 years, we've transformed the United States into the global leader in fighting climate change.
India didn't really want to join in. One reason they did was because of pushing and persuasion from the U.S. If that force leaves, you immediately create the question for the rest of the world. Well, if they're not doing it, why should we? And you lose this power that has been sort of an enforcer of the deal.
Okay, so Coral, help me understand this. The president campaigned on the pledge to get out of this agreement. His political allies, especially coal miners expect him to pull out of this. So why hasn't he pulled out of it?
So there was sort of an expectation that he would move to act on this pretty quickly. One reason he hasn't is that he's got a lot of forces saying the trade-offs of doing this are just not worth it. The diplomatic fallout from this, the way the U.S. would look on the world stage would be really bad. I talked to one diplomat from the Bush administration who said there's pretty much nothing else that we could walk away from or reject other than NATO that would really harm U.S. standing, that would hurt other economic deals, that would hurt U.S. credibility. And businesses that all have to work internationally, that all have to work abroad, that's sort of the push from some of President Trump's foreign policy advisors, including a lot of Republicans.
It's really interesting you mentioned business, because we keep finding that President Trump really values the opinions of business leaders on a range of issues. What exactly are corporate leaders saying about the Paris Climate Accord?
The voices that have been most active from the corporate world, including, very importantly, the fossil fuel world, the giants of fossil fuel, have said the Paris Agreement is a good idea and the United States should stay in it. If there is going to be a multilateral, universal pact aimed at phasing out fossil fuels, American fossil fuel companies want the U.S. to be in that pact.
And why is that?
So the best example of this is ExxonMobil, which is it's a U.S. company, but it has to operate internationally. If it's going to operate in countries around the world that are pushing forward with regulations or carbon taxes, it would like to have its home government involved.
Okay, well, we can't talk about ExxonMobil without talking about our now Secretary of State.
I first heard of climate change and the risk of climate change in about 1995.
Rex Tillerson, who was the CEO of Exxon.
The corporation has been studying climate change for a very long time, long before it was even part of the public vernacular.
Until he became a member of the Trump administration.
We have come to the conclusion that this is a serious risk.
Are we to guess that he is exerting some quiet influence in getting the president to not pull out of this talk?
Absolutely. So, you know, on the day the Paris Agreement was signed in 2015, ExxonMobil came out with a statement in support of the agreement. And that was when Rex Tillerson was CEO of the company. In his confirmation hearing, when he was asked about this,
I think it's important that the United States maintain its seat at the table.
He said the U.S. needs to have a seat at the table.
On the conversations around how to address threats of climate change, which do require a global response. No one country is going to solve this alone.
And as the U.S. Secretary of State, you don't really want to, you know, go around to different countries and have meetings where the first thing they bring up is, you know, why are you doing this? We can't trust the United States.
There's one person we haven't talked about, and he's important. He is Scott Pruitt. He is the head of the Environmental Protection Agency. Where does he stand on the Paris Agreement?
Scott Pruitt raised a lot of eyebrows.
Well, Paris is something that we need to really look at closely because it's something we need to exit, in my opinion.
I think that we need to exit the Paris Agreement.
It's a bad deal for America. It was an America's second, third, or fourth kind of approach. China and India had no obligations under the agreement until 2030. We front-loaded all of our costs.
What's your biggest objection to the Paris Agreement?
That America was put last.
That was a very strong statement. You know, Scott Pruitt is charged, of course, with unwinding President Obama's climate change regulations. He says it could make his kind of legal case harder for doing this. But he'll be weighing in against these other voices who say it's still not worth it.
But is it possible that there's some sort of halfway version of this where the president essentially pulls out of these accords but doesn't really pull out of them?
This is the option that's emerging as a likely outcome. The sort of halfway version would be we're staying in, we're not going to meet the targets that Obama said we're going to meet. We're going to withdraw those and we're going to submit a weaker, lighter plan that doesn't rely on the shutdown of all these coal-fired power plants. That would raise some eyebrows. It would create some frowns, but it doesn't have this sort of shattering impact of, you know, picking up all your toys and walking out of the room.
Coral, thank you very much. Really appreciate it. We will talk soon.
Great. Always great to be with you.
Do you have that letter near you? Because I wondered if you might read a little bit.
Sure. The letter I sent to Administrator Pruitt?
Yeah. A few weeks ago, we got a copy of a letter addressed to the new head of the Environmental Protection Agency, Scott Pruitt.
Dear Administrator Pruitt.
From a man named Mike Cox.
My name is Michael Cox. Today is my last day after working at EPA for over 25 years. I am writing this note because I, along with many EPA staff, are becoming increasingly alarmed about the direction of EPA under your leadership. I understand there are people in the country who distrust EPA and think we are overreaching our mission. I believe we need to listen to those voices and try to make changes where warranted. However, I and many staff firmly believe the policies this administration is advancing are contrary to what the majority of American people who pay our salaries want EPA to accomplish. I have worked under six administrations with political appointees leading EPA from both parties. This is the first time I remember staff openly dismissing and mocking the environmental policies of an administration and, by extension, you, the individuals selected to implement the policies.
That same day, March 31st, Mike retired. Michael, what was it that motivated you to ever want to work at the EPA?
This sounds corny, but I've always just thought public service was something that I thought that I really wanted to do. And EPA's mission, which is to protect human health and environment, that really resonated with me. And I really thought I could maybe make a difference.
So a few days before you retired...
With today's executive action, I am taking historic steps to lift the restrictions on American energy.
President Trump visited the EPA headquarters, surrounded by coal miners, to sign an executive order that unraveled key aspects of President Obama's environmental legacy.
To reverse government intrusion and to cancel job-killing regulations.
What was the scene there?
The chief of staff for Administrator Pruitt sent out a all-staff note. And the headline was, Our Big Day Today.
Mm-hmm.
Peculiar that this is our day.
The action I'm taking today will eliminate federal overreach, restore economic freedom, and allow our companies and our workers to thrive, compete, and succeed on a level playing field for the first time in a long time, fellas. It's been a long time.
It felt like a poke in the eye. It felt unnecessary. He could have signed those at the White House.
Mm-hmm.
It just didn't sit very well.
The miners told me about the attacks on their jobs and their livelihoods. They told me about the efforts to shut down their mines.
At that news conference, the president made a series of comments to the coal miners around him.
I made them this promise. We will put our miners back to work.
What did you make of that?
Well, you know, I have empathy for them, and I think we as a society have to do a better job of bridging when we have industries that are suffering and are having a hard time, like the coal industry, and we need to do that. I think, you know, the president and myself could agree on that one, but what disturbed me was this false hope, as I called it, and I think false hope because if you look at the data, over time, The coal industry, the employment in the coal industry has been declining for decades, long before President Obama came into office, for example.
So last month on this show...
I went to work at 18 years old working underground in a coal mine.
I had a chance to speak to a coal miner from Kentucky. His name was Mark Gray.
My mom raised 8 kids on a coal miner's pay. I've raised 4 kids on a coal miner's pay. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And I was struck by how much he identified with his profession, even though it caused him some serious medical problems.
It was tough on my body. I've got black lung right now. But I would, if I had it to do over again, guess what? I would make the same choice. Because I loved coal mining.
When I tried to bring up the environmental dangers of coal and how Mark's life work might not, maybe really even should not, continue in the future, he wasn't absorbing that. He was really resistant. How do you, as somebody who's spent a career on the other side of this debate, talk to people with that kind of experience and those kind of views?
Yeah, no, it's not easy. And I did listen to that podcast, and you know, it was heartfelt. You know, I really felt that. And it's a challenge, Michael. And what I try to do in those situations is try to, as best I can, say this is my understanding of what the science is. And if you look at the percentage of electricity that's supplied by coal And then you look at the percentage of greenhouse gases that are produced by coal. The coal produces much more greenhouse gases than it does in proportion to the electricity that it's generating.
Mm-hmm.
And then, after that, try to listen. Let's have a conversation and listen. Other than kind of demonizing both sides, because he's a good-intentioned man, and I think I'm good-intentioned, too. And there's a place we have to figure out how to meet to have that conversation.
Michael, did you get a response to your letter from anyone at the EPA?
No, I have not. No official. I mean, some staff have thanked me. People at EPA frustrated, and I think what I've provided is a voice for some of them to feel that, yeah, there is a voice out there that's saying what I wanted to say, but I really can't. So I guess I was hoping that would help some people too.
Well, Michael, thank you very much for coming on and sharing your letter with us. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you for the opportunity, Michael. Have a good day.
Good luck. Bye.
Bye-bye.
We'll be right back. Finally today, the story of a U.S. aircraft carrier that was supposed to be traveling up from Singapore toward North Korea.
And we have a Fox News vote for you now. The USS Navy Carrier Strike Group now heading toward the Korean Peninsula in a new show of force.
Analysts say the Vincent Strike Group has two destroyers and a cruiser with more than 300 combined missile tubes.
It's in response to recent provocations by North Korea. An official with the Defense Department says the ships will provide a show of presence in the region.
You redirected Navy ships to go toward the Korean Peninsula. What are we doing right now in terms of North Korea?
President Trump was asked about the deployment.
We are sending an armada, very powerful. We have submarines, very powerful, far more powerful than the aircraft carrier, that I can tell you.
And suggested it would send a signal to North Korea and give him more options in responding to its nuclear provocations. His press secretary, Sean Spicer, suggested the same.
I think when you see a carrier group steaming into an area like that, the forward presence of that is clearly, through almost every instance, a huge deterrence. So I think it serves multiple capabilities.
But there was a problem with that story.
At the moment that Sean Spicer was talking about the aircraft carrier's mission, the aircraft carrier was actually sailing in the opposite direction.
Mark Landler covers the White House for the Times.
It was going south, not north. It was heading down to the Indian Ocean south of Indonesia, where it was going to take part in a military exercise with the Australian Navy.
So it wasn't a case where the aircraft carrier was being sent as a show of force.
Well, the issue was that the Navy was planning to send, and in fact has since begun sending, the aircraft carrier up to the Korean Peninsula. The problem was the Navy put out a news release that made it sound like we're sending this aircraft carrier to the Sea of Japan immediately. There was basically a major misunderstanding about the timeline. The White House and everyone else in the world thought that this aircraft carrier was going to go immediately up to the Sea of Japan. That wasn't the case. It had to do this other thing first.
Mark, is what you're telling me that the White House doesn't know where a major aircraft carrier is or is about to be?
Well, White House officials say that they were going off the guidance they got from the Pentagon. And the White House says they were not informed about this intermediate step, which involves sailing in the opposite direction.
So what does this tell us about this White House and the way it operates?
Well, I think I would chalk it up to growing pains, frankly. I think that there was clearly a drop ball here. The White House was not told, apparently, that their timeline was wrong. Now, you know, if you're a conspiracy theorist, you could speculate that, in fact, this all played out nicely for the White House, that they wanted to send this message of deterrence. They wanted to have this display of military might. And that even if they had found out kind of midway through the process that, gee, this aircraft carrier is not going to get to the Korean Peninsula for another week and a half, it might have been difficult or politically disadvantageous to sort of take back this whole narrative. It might have sent some mixed messages. That's not what they're telling us. What they're telling us is that they genuinely didn't know. They were going off the guidance that they had.
Sounds like a case of accidentally kind of genius strategic ignorance.
And that, by the way, is something you could say of not just this incident, but of several others that this new president has involved himself in.
Mark, thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Michael.
The competing stories came to light when the Navy posted a photo on Monday of the aircraft carrier sailing through a strait that separates the Indonesian islands of Java and Sumatra, 2,500 miles away from the Korean Peninsula. That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you tomorrow.